Welcome to Oncology Today, current and future role of menin inhibitors in patients with acute myeloid leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Gus Issa from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. In addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Issa's slide presentation. During the program, the use of agents and treatments that are not approved will be discussed, so please check out the package inserts for more, and the conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. After my session with Dr. Issa, I again met with him for a follow-up discussion, and this additional interview follows this one. To begin, I told Dr. Issa about a CME program we recently recorded. I'll share with you an interesting experience I had a few days ago. I did a program on AML with Jorge Cortez. I don't know if you were at MD Anderson at the same time he was.
He was my mentor before he left.
Oh, really? Right. So anyhow, you know, and most of what we talked about was FLT3. And I'm watching him go through, you know, Ratify and all the newer trials. And I was all of a sudden, and I don't know where this applies. I shared with him, and I don't know whether this applies to, you know, general medical oncologists who don't see AML all the time. But I was realizing, really for the first time, how much these FLT3 agents, how effective they are. I mean, the hazard rate on a lot of these trials for survival is in the range of 0.5. And you look across oncology, you don't see it that often. And I think when people think about AML, they think about 7 plus 3 and transplant intensive therapy. And here's an oral therapy that has that type of benefit. So, I mean, I have to confess, like I said, I don't know if I'm in, you know, typical or atypical and not realizing how powerful FLT3 inhibitors are. I assume you agree with that. But in that context, can you give us a feel for this new pathway and new agent? Is it that? I mean, I know you don't have the phase 3 trials yet, but is it your sense that these are maybe as effective or more effective than, for example, FLT3 inhibitors?
We hope so. As far as monotherapy, if you take a menin inhibitor or the FLT3 inhibitors that were approved, the chances of response are similar. And that was the basis for approval of revumenib, because, you know, the benchmarks put by the FDA are based on all these targeted therapies like IDH inhibitors and FLT3 inhibitors. So we have randomized phase 3 data from FLT3 inhibitors, and we know that they improve survival. And we're hoping that because menin inhibitors have a different mechanism of action, not like 7 plus 3 or Aza-Ven, and because they have single agent activity like FLT3 inhibitors, and because, you know, they are tolerable agents that can be combined with chemo, that we would have similar hazards ratio to FLT3 inhibitors when combining them with 7 plus 3. And hopefully that would extend survival or even decrease the need for transplant.
Yeah, that was, you know, what I was, as I was watching and review the data, that was what struck me. And I was thinking about what you just presented in that same context, that when you look at it as monotherapy and relapse disease, it's kind of hard to get a feel. I mean, it's not all that spectacular, but then you bring in an earlier in combination is when you see these really interesting effects. And that kind of leads into the mechanisms here. And you did a great job going through it with the slides. And I want you to take a shot at going through it without slides, like you're making rounds and you're walking down the hall. And just talk a little bit, you know, because I think this concept of differentiation therapy, so to speak, which I guess this is, was that what you would call it?
Correct, yeah. I'll tell you I explain it to my patients.
Even better. Perfect.
Yeah. So I usually tell them that this is like, for example, for KMT2A rearranged leukemias, it's almost like two wires crossed, the two chromosomes that cause a short circuit, and that short circuit causes an abnormal gene expression, like a abnormal software that you would not want on your computer. And that causes these cells to turn into zombie cells, cells that should have died but are not dead, that are dependent on this program. And menin inhibitors create a wedge between the key and the engine. They disrupt the critical protein that causes this abnormal software and reverses it back into the normal software. So the cells change identities. Instead of being leukemia cells, they morph into these normal cells again. So that's the differentiating therapy effect. It is not working by killing cells that grow fast. It is reminding these cells again that, you know, they used to be normal neutrophils and that they don't need to stay alive and eternal, dependent on this zombie-like state, and they can go back to normal cells and die off and eventually are replaced by normal cells.
That's great. In a second, I'll ask you to use that kind of approach to explain differentiation syndrome. But first, kind of tracking back, it looks like, first of all, I guess HOX upregulation is a key element of tumors that respond to menin. What is HOX, and can you do an assay on it?
Yes, great question. So HOX is that zombie state gene expression program that I was trying to explain. So in normal hematopoiesis, HOXA9 or HOX program and their critical cofactor MACE1 is restricted to stem cells. And it is a critical gene expression program for normal development. But in this case, these alterations are hijacking this program and assuming this identity of a stem-like state. We don't have clinical assays that would measure HOXA9 and MACE1. We could do it by RNA-seq, and we try to see differentially expressed genes compared to responders, not responders. But to have a clinical assay, we need a robust, validated assay that would allow quantitative measurement of this gene. So if we do the test in Miami or we do it in Houston, we get the same answer. And more importantly, we also need a clear quantitative threshold that would tell us this is high, this is low. We're not there yet. That's the goal of this trial that I'm trying to do.
And again, it kind of looks like, I don't know if it's empiric or it makes, I guess, theoretical sense why KMT2A and NPM1 genomic variations would respond to that. Is there a sort of biological theory why?
Yeah. There's a lot of work that has started, with multiple people, but the seminal work had been led by Yolanta Grembecka at University of Michigan and Scott Armstrong at Dana-Farber. And they've established that in these models of KMT2A rearranged leukemias or NPM1 mutant leukemias, they have high expression of HOXA9 and MACE1, and that this expression is dependent on menin interacting with KMT2A. The way in each of these genotypes how this leads to upregulation of HOXA9 and MACE1 is slightly different, but it's almost like this program is so critical for leukemia that there have been different ways where leukemia finds a way to cause it and survive through that mechanism.
So again, I sometimes draw analogies too much, but again, reflecting back on my conversation with your mentor, the thing that really shocked me was when he started presenting data on FLT3 inhibitors and people without FLT3 mutations.
Yeah.
And he was showing me this FLT3-like assay type thing. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that when you talked about this trial you're doing now, looking at different genomic subsets in terms of whether they respond. Can you explain what you're thinking there?
Sure. So it's exactly what Dr. Cortez may have talked about. So in FLT3 inhibitors, the investigation started in FLT3 mutated leukemias, and there was single agent activity and clear response, although Dr. Cortez also worked on the development of quizartinib, and during the phase one, there was activity in the non-mutant FLT3. So now they took it a step further. Pau Montesinos in Spain had done the Kiwi study, which is a randomized phase two, that found benefit of the addition of quizartinib in what they call a FLT3-like signature. So in this case, this would be the HOX signature for menin inhibitors. In that Kiwi study, they just used RNA-seq try to identify patients that have that similar signature. And it's, a lot of genes to infer that clustering. So this is not something that can be deployed clinically as easily as a few genes. my goal is to get to an Oncotype DX type of scenario where maybe it's a few genes and a few housekeeping genes, and that allows us to quantitatively measure gene expression. And then it could be like the Oncotype DX trials. We would, you know, find out benefit of adjuvant chemo in some patients, so benefit of menin inhibitors in some of those patients, where beyond the genetic alterations, these would be patients that would benefit from the addition of these drugs.
So I was telling Dr. Cortez, actually, it made me think a little. I don't know if you work a lot with Dr. Shannon Weston from your group there in gynecologic
oncology. No, I know her well, but I'm very far from GenOnc. Yeah.
But anyhow, in ovarian cancer, they have an HRD and also endometrial, an HRD assay. So they have PARP inhibitors that work on PARP mutations, but then they have this signature. They're called loss of heterozygosity. And these people actually, this is an assay that these people actually seem to respond to PARP inhibitors. Is that kind of what you're trying to do here?
Yep, exactly. So inferring, trying to not just rely on genetic alterations, which are yes and no, trying to encompass more patients that may benefit through, you know, more broad assays.
So in terms of, as I mentioned, our primary target audience, the community-based general medical oncologists, in terms of where they're seeing patients with AML, which of course usually is older patients, but sometimes younger patients as well. In terms of menin inhibitors, like what advice do you give them to make sure they, I guess at this point it's for relapse disease. First of all, I would ask you from a clinical point of view, do these patients clinically benefit? Is it more of a numbers thing or on paper? Do they feel better? Do you see them responding? You showed a great picture there, extramedullary response. And so how do they make sure that they're picking up patients who might benefit? Of course, hopefully, it's going to come into first line upfront therapy in combination, but they need to be ready for that as well. But for now, it's relapse disease. How do they make sure they identify the right patient and how do they deal with it?
Yeah, so for sure, patients benefit. So the patients that were treated on study were given the option between hospice and enrolling on the clinical trial. And I still have patients alive now from 2019 after enrolling on the initial phase one trial. The key factor, though, is a stem cell transplant consolidation because they're in relapsed refractory disease. So they would benefit. The treatment is a pill, nothing like chemotherapy. There are some slight side effects. Some patients may have nausea. Some patients may have change in taste, but it's really minimal compared to chemo. So they can go on with their normal life outpatient taking these pills. And they will have, in about 20% of cases, they will have 20 to 25%. They have full count recovery. So they don't need transfusions anymore. And they are just taking this pill at home. But the key to ensuring cure, hopefully, or improving durability of response, especially in relapsed refractory disease, is in the consolidation with a stem cell transplant. And in many of my cases, I've had to do a second and a third transplant because those patients were so heavily pretreated.
So, of course, what you mentioned, the issue of differentiation syndrome, and actually I was also talking to Dr. Cortez about IDH inhibitors. So I gave him the shot at explaining his vision of how differentiation syndrome works. I'll ask you, your talk, you went through it very, very well. But again, can you maybe take a step back and, sort of not just as it relates to these menin inhibitors, but differentiation syndrome and other situations with APL and IDH inhibitors, what your vision is, how it plays out in these patients, and how you go about trying to detect it early?
Sure. So differentiation syndrome is caused by, the leukemia cells turning back into normal cells when the differentiation arrest is lifted by these drugs, either IDH or atra-arsenic or FLT3 or menin inhibitors. And for reasons we don't fully understand, in some patients, this could be associated with a cytokine imbalance. Some of these cells, while they're turning from leukemia into normal, may secrete some cytokines that would cause a capillary leak, a little bit of a cytokine storm, and some infiltration of those maturing cells into organs, the lungs or the kidneys. So that's the basis of these of the differentiation syndrome. Clinically, I will have a high index of suspicion for anyone who's on a menin inhibitor when they start treatment. That's because the time to differentiation syndrome roughly is within 1 to 2 weeks. So it happens at the beginning of the treatment. That's mostly for revumenib. For ziftomenib, it's a little longer. Could happen up to a month or 2 months. And that's related to the half-life of the drug. Ziftomenib has a longer half-life. So what I tell my staff, what I tell my patients, because I give them a card to tell them about menin inhibitors, is that if they have any fever, joint aches, bone aches, chest pain, trouble breathing, rash, any of these signs, to come in and get evaluated. And the things we look for is looking at the blood counts, try to see if there's an increase in the white count. Sometimes differentiation is associated with increase in white count, the leukemia cells turning into normal. We may do a chest x-ray because sometimes there could be pleural or pericardial effusions. We may do an echo if there's a pericardial effusion. We look at the kidney function. We evaluate all these joint aches, bony aches, and at any suspicion, I would do steroids. This is high-dose steroids, so dexamethasone, 10 milligrams twice a day for 3 days, regardless of the symptoms, whether they improve or not, because we don't want the syndrome to recur. And very commonly in differentiation syndrome, either with menin inhibitors or IDH or ATRA and arsenic, a dose of steroids could be diagnostic. Patients feel 100% better just with the first dose. And this way you would know that you're on the right track. But also, it's more of a, you know, risks-benefits scenario. Because differentiation syndrome can be deadly, it's better to err on the side of steroids than wait to ensure that the diagnosis is right, and then it's too late to correct it.
How often do you see sort of fulminant differentiation syndrome, you know, life-threatening? Is that usually because the diagnosis wasn't made, or sometimes it just presents that way?
We're still learning more about it with menin inhibitors. It could be a little different than ATRA and arsenic and IDH inhibitors. In the majority of the cases, differentiation syndrome is grade 3 or less, and it can be picked up just by these symptoms. I'd say grade 4 or the death are, you know, cases that have been counted at least 5 in the literature, something like that, among 100 or 200 patients. We still have to define it better when it gets into clinical practice. And also, more importantly, you know, it could be, we don't know yet how much of it is related to not recognizing the syndrome versus and start of steroids early versus that simply some differentiation syndrome cases are very fulminant, like you described. What's interesting is that just like an APL or an IDH inhibitors, when we use these agents with combination therapy, the rate of differentiation syndrome falls down dramatically. So the addition of chemotherapy or other agents cuts down on these cytokines and decreases the rate of differentiation syndrome.
Any evidence or any work being done on the use of menin inhibitors outside of AML?
Yeah, a lot. So there's a lot of preclinical data. Because menin is an epigenetic regulator, that menin inhibition could be useful for prostate cancer, for breast cancer. There is some preclinical data about menin inhibition affecting MHC1 molecule expression. So there's a paper in Nature Cell Biology showing that menin inhibition could potentiate T cell killing in a small cell lung cancer model. There's data on menin inhibitors in improving diabetes. In fact, one of the companies, Biomea, is focusing only on diabetes now. Wow. And there is very good data on GIST. So GIST having KIT mutations and KIT mutations dependent on gene expression that could be reversed by menin inhibition. And that's why the menin inhibitor ziftomenib is currently being investigated in GIST. There's also a clinical trial of the menin inhibitor revumenib in colon cancer. So there's a lot. We still need to know the clinical data and see if we're going to get the same answers.
For some reason, when you mentioned it's used in prostate cancer, I flashed on the fact we did a CME program at the AUA, American Urologic Association, this year on AKT inhibitors. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a urologist dealing with differentiation syndrome?
Well, I don't know how it looks in solid organs. The differentiating agents in solid tumors are...
That's true. I guess you wouldn't see it. Right.
You wouldn't see, I don't know. Maybe.
Right. Well, no, it's just the idea of using targeted therapy by urologists struck me, because there you got to worry about diabetes or glucose intolerance, et cetera.
Right.
But no, that's a good point. Actually, I was talking about that with Jorge, the fact that I don't, like you see, you know, IDH inhibitors are used in biliary tract cancer, but I don't think they see differentiation syndrome.
Right.
Any idea why, incidentally?
I don't know if it's something related to blood cells and having like more prone to these cytokine storms, or is it related to any differentiation, like a biliary tract tumor or glioma not necessarily secreting a lot of these cytokines when the IDH is blocked. So I don't know.
So I want to go to your cases now. So 45-year-old lady, what happened with her?
So she had breast cancer. She had resection and adjuvant chemo. And then a year later, that's when she came to my clinic with AML and translocation 611. I guess the point that's important to highlight here is that KMT2A rearranged leukemias, like this case, it's caused by translocation 611, is therapy related. About 70% of the therapy related cases, especially after a topo 2 inhibitor, so frequently after breast cancer or lymphoma, they may develop KMT2A rearranged leukemias. And she had standard of care, 7+3. The chances of response in KMT2A to 7+3 is lower than other leukemias, but it's still decent. It's about 60%, roughly. So she responded and went to transplant. But the issue is the rate of relapse. So she relapsed 5 months post-transplant. That's when I met her. She enrolled on the clinical trial, received revumenib, and had a complete remission. Unfortunately, she developed seizures and eventually found to have CNS leukemias. And the point I would highlight here is that menin inhibitors, these small molecules, don't cross the blood-brain barrier. So they would not prevent CNS leukemia. So in a lot of these cases now that we're treating with any of the menin inhibitors or the menin inhibitors without high-dose cytarabine combination, it's very important to give prophylaxis with IT chemo to prevent CNS leukemia.
So it's interesting. So I guess you view her as a secondary leukemia, although she had the chemo like a year ago.
Right. So that's the
seems pretty
critical.
It seems kind of quick.
No, that's exactly typical for KMT2A. So it's faster than the P53-5-7 acute myeloid leukemia after an alkylating agent. So for those leukemias that are therapy-related after an alkylating agent, the median time to leukemia is long, about 4 years, 5 years. But for KMT2A, it could be as short as 6 months. And that's even harder because sometimes we may end up dealing with two cancers. They are not done with the first sarcoma or breast cancer, and they have leukemia. This is very typical of KMT2A, 1 year.
That's really interesting. I was talking with Jorge about the issue of combining CPX with FLT3 inhibitors. I didn't know whether people just substitute CPX or they need to see data with it with targeted therapy, but are there trials looking at CPX plus menin?
Not that I'm aware of. And I don't think there's anything magical about CPX and therapy-related KMT2A. I would say, 7+3, essentially. There may be something about CPX and MDS-related changes or MDS-related AML, which we don't understand why it works better. But I don't think there's anything special about KMT2A that would make them more susceptible to CPX.
Can you talk a little bit more about what happened with this woman? Did she have any tolerability issues at all with the treatment? And what complications have you seen? You mentioned in your talk something I thought was really interesting. I wasn't expecting the MEN1 syndrome.
Yeah.
Maybe you can go through that and the other unusual things that can happen.
So, no, she tolerated the treatment well. No side effects at all that I can recall. The MEN1 syndrome is more theoretical. So menin is the protein from MEN1. And MEN1 is a mutation in the menin gene that would lead to loss of function of that gene. And in that case, in parathyroid or pituitary or pancreas, this is what these are the tumors in Menwein syndrome, it leads to these tumors, these slow-growing tumors at first, and then it could be neuroendocrine tumors. Menin inhibitors are inducing loss of menin, but through a different way. Essentially, it's disrupting the menin-KMT2A interaction. And so far, you know, we've had up to 6 years on these trials. We haven't heard of any case of Menwein syndrome on patients treated. But it's still a caution in the package label, package insert. And a lot of the trials that we've done, you know, the FDA ensures monitoring of endocrine parameters, you know, FSH, LH, TSH, et cetera. And we haven't seen any major change in these numbers when we treated patients.
And you also had mentioned during your talk myelosuppression. How often do you see it? And did this lady have any myelosuppression? And do you ever need to use growth factors?
Yeah. So this lady didn't. She had a full remission. That, you know, she's more in the 20 to 25% chances of response. But the overall response rate is 60%. So in AML, response is defined by blasts going down to less than 5% in the bone marrow and count recovery. So if they have full count recovery, this would be called a complete remission. If they have a partial or incomplete count recovery, these would be counted in the overall response rate, but not, you know, in CR/CRh. So in other words, there's an additional 20 to 30% of cases that have their blasts go down, but the counts don't improve. If you try to quantify, you know, just regardless of whether the investigators said that the thrombocytopenia or neutropenia is related to the menin inhibitor, on single agent, it would be roughly about 20 to 30%. Ziftomenib seems to have less of an effect on thrombocytopenia or neutropenia. And growth factors are highly encouraged, in my opinion, especially when they reach MRD negative disease. I don't hesitate about using them.
You went through a number of slides in your talk related to mechanisms of resistance, which I found really fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, sort of globally what we've learned about that?
We've learned that this is for the first time an epigenetic therapy that has a direct genetic mechanism of resistance. So it's disrupting the key interaction that causes the epigenetic dysregulation. That was the only way in this case that the leukemia could bypass this strong inhibition. So it showed that this interaction is critical. This is such an important therapeutic selection that only, you know, by changing the shape of the pocket that leukemia could come back. So this tells us that even, just like I said during the talk, even if these are not the menin inhibitors that we would use in the future, that we could potentially just focus on menin and KMT2A interaction in the future as a critical node. And maybe we would end up also with you know, dasatinib to imatinib, or the pirtobrutinibs to ibrutinib, newer generation of inhibitors with less side effects and more potency and selectivity.
I'm so glad you mentioned pirtobrutinib, because I was about to sort of embarrassingly ask you whether this is in any way analogous to what you see with BTK inhibitors, because it kind of sounds a little bit like pirtobrutinib versus covalent, but am I not seeing that right?
I don't know about the covalent part of the equation yet. I don't know if it adds up to any of the effects of menin inhibitors. I mean, what's really special about pirto is that, you know, it works even when they've progressed on all these BTK inhibitors, and it's very well tolerated. We're now using it frontline at MD Anderson. It's a wonderful drug. Hopefully we'll get something in for menin inhibitors one day for that. But we're still also very early. I mean, we could also, with these first-generation menin inhibitors, we're probably going to get much more mileage in combination where we would have less resistance.
You know, it's interesting you said it's kind of early, because in one of the first slides you showed, which is sort of a timeline that goes all the way back to like 1977, yeah. And I was thinking, it's been around a long time, actually, but finally something got approved, but it's been in development for a long time.
The science behind it has been in development for a long time, and it took like everything. It took incremental science and work from a lot of people. But I think the major breakthroughs were discovering that menin is a key factor for KMT2A rearranged leukemias, and also establishing the structure of menin and finding that pocket. The important thing I wanted to highlight is that nothing happens overnight. It takes a lot of work. But also, some of my favorite things to do now is just to go back at review articles from 10 years ago on epigenetics and leukemia. And there's no mention of menin inhibitors at all. Zero. And that's not because they didn't exist, but somehow we were like stuck in this world where epigenetics were not, I mean, Graham Becker knew about it for sure, or Armstrong knew about them for sure.
I'm curious for your thoughts on some of the ongoing trials looking at menin inhibitors, not only combining with upfront therapy, whether it's HMA venetoclax or venetoclax, I think you mentioned also, as well as a chemotherapy 7+3. But also I was curious about, you mentioned an interest in looking at MRD status.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We are trying to come up with better assays for measurable residual disease so we can detect leukemia, you know, beyond morphologic remission at very low levels, hopefully one cell in a million. But more importantly, we're trying to come up with methods to intervene on MRD. So not just say that MRD is there and it's bad, but there's not much we could do. We just wait for relapse. We want to come up with trials that show that if we intervene at the time of MRD, hopefully there would be less toxicity because, you know, there's not major organ damage by leukemia and there's less disease burden. So hopefully medicines would be more effective and prevent relapse.
Again, my mind always wanders into other things I've heard, just like every community oncologist, things flying by you. And, you know, again, kind of an interesting concept presented at ASCO plenary in breast cancer, where they treated patients who had developed ESR1 mutations. This is not an MRD assay. This is just genomic mechanism of resistance, essentially, where they treated the patient at that point. Is that a feasible strategy in AML?
So identifying a mutation at the level of MRD, yes. So in this case, it would be identifying NPM1 or KMT2A. So beyond just description of AML, a molecular identification of mutations hopefully would guide us to a targeted therapy.
All right, let's hear about this 72-year-old lady.
Yes, this is one of the first patients I've treated. So 72-year-old monocytic acute myeloid leukemia. This is just to highlight that this is common with NPM1, about 30%, and co-mutations in DNMT3A, TAT2, and RAS. These are, you know, mutations that co-occur. She had leukocytosis that happens with monocytic leukemia, especially with RAS mutation. You know, you could substitute RAS and say FLT3 and you may have the same phenotype. So usually those patients, the standard of care is HMA venetoclax, but very important is to try to reduce the count before starting HMA and venetoclax. So she got Hydrea, which controlled the counts well. And then she got Aza and Ven, and she had a response. But what happens in older patients or those that have a background CHIP is that they may not have a complete remission. They may have a response, but the counts remain low for a long time, and it's hard to give these subsequent cycles. This could be because she has residual leukemia or because she has a background messed up hematopoiesis from CHIP. So eventually she relapsed, so 7 months. And then we tend to do repeat mutational analysis on all our patients. And in this case, it's very important just to find out for targeted therapies. For example, she could acquire a FLT3 mutation. In that case, the treatment would be different. In 5% of the cases, there is loss of NPM1 at relapse. So it's important to make sure you do the analysis. For KMT2A, it's probably less important. KMT2A is detected at relapse in 100% of the cases. But it will also there could be some KMT2A rearranged cases that are missed at diagnosis, and that's why it's important to do them at relapse. So we repeated the mutational analysis. We found the same mutations, and she was treated on ziftomenib. You know, if you look at first cycle on ziftomenib, in a lot of the cases, you would do the bone marrow, and some people may think that there's no response. because the blast percentage had not changed. She felt great, her counts improved, but the bone marrow blasts and the, you know, were the same. And that's because pathologists are really struggling to call response in those cells that are differentiating. They're not immediately evident under the microscope that these are cells that are about to disappear. So enzyphthoma, a time to response is longer. It's about 2 months. So she stayed on the treatment for about another cycle. And the next cycle, she was in complete remission. So the reason why I'm discussing this case is that these inhibitors are epigenetic therapies. It takes a little more patience to keep them. Just like what we used to say for HMAs a while ago, before HMA event. So if they're deriving benefit, if there's no clear progression, probably would err on the side of keeping the menin inhibitor and trying to see if this is eventually going to turn into a full response.
So what you described there with her white count going up and persistent, quote, blasts in the marrow, is that typical for all menin inhibitors or just zifto?
It seemed to be happening more with zifto, but it's possible with any of the menin inhibitors. And this could be related to the half-life of the drug and the tissue penetration of each drug, which may lead to different phenotypes that we see in patients.
Zifto, that's a lot easier to say, I think. Maybe that's a good nickname for it. Anything else that we haven't discussed today that you want to bring up, particularly from the point of view of docs and community-based practice, about AML in general, but particularly as it relates to menin inhibitors?
No, not really. Just think of these therapies for KMT2A rearranged leukemias or NPM1 mutant leukemias. I'm hoping these therapies would be broadly available soon for all patients who could benefit.
Just out of curiosity, is there enough activity that you would theoretically consider using it as monotherapy up front in a 90 or 95-year-old who could not get more intensive therapy?
I don't know. So I don't know what would happen frontline if we use that monotherapy. I also don't know if the differentiation syndrome would be worse if the leukemia is newly diagnosed. I would take it as a risks and benefits equation. HMA and venetoclax is relatively well tolerated, even in a 90-year-old. And what we're finding is that when we add the menin inhibitor to HMA and venetoclax, we are not increasing toxicity significantly in newly diagnosed patients. So I would probably, even if it's a 90-year-old, I would just dose adjust these medicines and try to deliver a therapy that would lead to a better remission, because a deeper remission would just last longer, and it's the best palliation anyone could do.
If you could, would you include a menin inhibitor as part of upfront therapy, either combined with initial therapy or maybe in maintenance?
If the data shows that, yes, that if those clinical trials hopefully show survival advantage, then it would make a lot of sense.
As mentioned in the introduction to this program, my initial meeting with Dr. Issa left me with a number of follow-up questions about this fascinating form of therapy, and he was kind enough to sit down with me again to elaborate on the concept of differentiation therapy. So first of all, when you look at, say, APL, would you say ATRA is a differentiating agent?
Yeah, absolutely. But not
arsenic, obviously, right? Or is it?
So probably ATRA more so than arsenic, but both
really?
Because arsenic probably is leading to degradation of the PML bodies that are responsible for APL, mm-hmm. and have some higher degree of apoptosis in APL, and is the more effective agent in APL. I'd say both agents are differentiating therapies. ATRA was the first example of a differentiating agent in leukemia. I guess there's an older example. I forgot what it's called. In AML, something ancient.
AML, right.
I'll find it. But something that didn't pan out but caused differentiation.
Okay, so just again, just to, you know, kind of get it out on the table again, would you call IDH inhibitors differentiating agents?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, and then menin, I guess, is differentiating. Menin, would you call menin differentiating or differentiating plus other mechanisms?
Mainly differentiating agents, similar to IDH inhibition, yeah.
Okay, so I guess my very kind of naive thought was, as I think about these differentiating therapies, so to speak, is, does that mean that literally the cells go from being malignant to not normal or to non-malignant?
We can take the example of KMT2A rearranged leukemias because we can track them better. So the menin inhibition shuts down the transcription that causes leukemia, but the identity of the cell, the KMT2A fusion, the two chromosomes attached to each other, persists for a while. So if you do a bone marrow biopsy after one cycle of a menin inhibitor, you will find that under the microscope, those cells have turned normal. But if you do FISH, you will still find KMT2A fusions in those cells. Same for APL. Same for IDH if you track that mutation. So that is proving the differentiating nature of this therapy because those cells retain their old identity. In fact, you know, there are some cases where there is skin involvement with differentiation syndrome, and some of the investigators did FISH on what was thought to be Sweet syndrome, and they found the fusion in those neutrophils, those cells that are now normal, proving that, you know, those cells used to be malignant and migrated into the normal phenotype while still carrying that fusion.
And that stays indefinitely, or does it eventually go away?
No, because the cells, those differentiating cells, are no longer addicted to a program that keeps them alive, they die off like normal hematopoietic cells and are replaced eventually by other cells that don't have the fusion. And that's why in APL and in KMT2A, if you wait a cycle or two, the FISH would turn normal, and it is not an indicator of residual disease.
So I guess the biggest question I had is, what does this mean in terms of understanding the pathogenesis of cancer? It sounds like you're sort of reversing it. Like, what does that mean?
Right.
And you also said that menin inhibitors work in like solid tumors.
Right, but that may be different. In case of solid tumors, it is affecting the expression of a particular receptor, like the estrogen receptor or KIT in GIST or the androgen receptor in prostate cancer. It is not directly intervening on the oncogene that causes those cancers and blocking the main signal. So I don't know if we're going to see differentiation in GIST, for example. But there are examples of differentiation in neuroblastoma, for example, as a solid tumor. And in my previous life in the lab, I worked on bromodomain inhibitors. And something that bromodomain inhibitors do for a rare solid tumor called NUT midline carcinoma is that they lead to differentiation of these, you know, to what would be almost squamous cells into normal cells.
So again, like, what does this mean in terms of going the other way, you know, the mm-hmm. malignant process? Does it say anything about that?
I wish we could come up with more differentiating agents for solid tumors, but determining that phenotype in solid tumors is harder, and probably that, you know, the complexity of or clonal heterogeneity in solid tumors is more prevalent.
I'm not asking about solid tumors. What I'm trying to say is, for some reason, people develop AML.
Mm-hmm.
They have malignant cells, and you know they have all the consequences of AML. You're saying that these therapies reverse that process. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. does it tell us something about how the process occurs in the first place? Like
it tells
why
us
you
that
get
these,
cancer?
The, I don't think it informs us why these alterations happen. It just solidifies that these alterations, like KMT2A, are the central events in leukemia, and it is sufficient to block KMT2A gene expression to lead to remission, because it's a critical alteration in the pathogenesis of KMT2A. But I don't think it informs us on why KMT2A rearrangements happen.
I mean, again, it's kind of a basic question, but is it your vision that basically cancers, liquid and solid, are the result of a alteration in the genome or the expression of the genome, that it's kind of a genetic disease?
That's the best explanation. There's still more unknowns about epigenetic changes. In other words, you know, changes in gene expression or plasticity without a clear genetic alteration in encoding area, so something that affects transcription. But it could be just mutations that are not identified, or mutations in a dark genome, so parts that are not coded but affect expression, like enhancers or other gene modulators.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about, would you say it's possible or likely that over the next few years there may be multiple menin inhibitors available to treat AML?
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, we know for sure that both revumenib and ziftomenib have submitted for FDA approval. Revumenib submitted for an sNDA, so for the indication of NPM1 mutant AML, and ziftomenib submitted for a new drug application for an NDA for NPM1 mutant AML. And both the PDUFA date, so the date by which the FDA would complete the review, is similar, by the end of this year. So there's a good chance we'll have multiple soon. And then there are multiple in clinical trials that look very promising. So I wouldn't be surprised that it would be similar to FLT3 inhibitors.
So actually, you know, of course, we do CME for all parts of oncology, and we've been doing a lot of programs. You might have noticed that one of the plenary presentations this year was on a SERD, selective estrogen receptor downregulator, mm-hmm. they do in ER-positive breast cancer. There's only one currently approved, but the big paper at ASCO was one that's not approved, maybe is going to be approved in the near future. And then there was another one last December at the big San Antonio meeting that also with really positive data. So, and then there's a PROTAC, which is a different mechanism. So, and then, you know, the oncologist who's in general practice, and I think these menin inhibitors are going to be an issue for them to understand, are faced with multiple agents. They have to, and like I said, for example, SERDs right now, we just did another program on that a couple of days ago. Can you separate out the toxicity? Is there a difference in, you know, schedule? And this comes up by specifics also in a bunch of tumors. So I guess my question is, right now, how would you profile the existing agents that are out there? You mentioned revumenib and zilfimenib. You also, during the talk, talked about blexamenib, emulemunib, and a couple others. So could you kind of go through, you know, maybe three or four of these and just basically talk about what it is, what's been seen so far, what kind of trials is it being studied in right now, and where you see things heading?
Sure. So I'll start with the two that are most advanced and with the most results, revumenib and ziftomenib. The main differences are that revumenib is twice a day, ziftomenib is once a day. Revumenib is dependent on CYP3A, so co-administration of a CYP3A inhibitor like poza or vori affects the level of revumenib, so you have to adjust the dose, just like venetoclax. Ziftomenib does not require adjustments of the dose by CYP3A co-administration. Revumenib is approved for KMT2A rearrangements and has positive phase 2 data in NPM1 mutant AML, so potentially approved for NPM1. Ziftomenib has only positive phase 2 data in NPM1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia, so the potential indication as monotherapy for ziftomenib will be NPM1 mutant acute myeloid leukemia. The rate of differentiation syndrome in both is mostly similar. Severe differentiation syndrome is about 10 to 15%. Revumenib causes QT prolongation. Ziftomenib does not. Ziftomenib has a mild side effect of itching, which is not seen with revumenib. And then there are multiple studies in combinations, either 7 plus 3 plus menin or azaven plus menin, and the results look great for both, for the 7 plus 3 portion at least. And there are randomized pivotal studies planned for both, which would be testing the addition of ziftomenib or revumenib to standard of care. So there's a 7 plus 3, you know, menin frontline for either, or azaven frontline for either. And then there are other menin inhibitors that are coming along sooner, like in the near future, blexmenib with less single agent data so far that is published, only abstracts presented, which looks like it has similar efficacy, at least in NPM1, it looks like similar efficacy. And in combinations, it's looking good, but we haven't seen the full manuscripts yet. And the same for the menin inhibitor, enzomenib. The last menin inhibitor with clinical data that looks good is a compound from a company in China called BioNova, which was just acquired, and it showed also similarly good response rates. So this is the lay of the land of the effective menin inhibitors.
That last one was BN-104?
Correct.
Do you ever see coexisting FLT3 or IDH mutations?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do? And then what do you do? Can you give them both together?
Yeah. So FLT3 is the most common co-mutation in either NPM1 or KMT2A. First, for KMT2A, so which are the subtypes targeted by menin inhibitors. For KMT2A, half the patients don't have any co-occurring mutation, but and the other half, if they do, the top mutations are RAS and FLT3. Whereas for NPM1, FLT3 ITD is the most common co-occurring mutation, roughly about 50% or 60%. There is excellent preclinical data on combining a menin inhibitor plus FLT3 inhibitor. We have a trial also starting at MD Anderson, combining the menin inhibitor ziftomenib with the FLT3 inhibitor quizartinib.
Any thoughts about using only targeted therapy, no azaven, no 7 plus 3 as upfront treatment, like a window of opportunity type thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be an interesting thing to test. We'll have to see the data. I think I really like venetoclax, so in most of the trials that I'm designing, I still like to keep the venetoclax component in the frontline studies. The hardest question is whether we can combine all and figure out a treatment that can be delivered without excessive toxicity. So there are now discussions about quadruplets. So it would be azacitidine, venetoclax, a menin inhibitor, and a FLT3 inhibitor. So trying to get to where myeloma is, for example.
So you mentioned trials, some of the new trial concept, including combinations with 7 plus 3 azaven. Any other studies that you're excited to see looking at menin inhibitors you want to comment on?
Mm-hmm. So I have an interest in targeting MRD, so intercepting relapse before it happens. And we have a trial that's ongoing that's combining revumenib plus venetoclax for MRD and trying to eradicate MRD so that relapses would be less. These trial concepts would not, you know, it's hard to lead to approval, although there is an example of blinatumomab approval based on a similar concept, but at least it gives us an idea about disease biology, about targeting MRD and rapidly testing combinations. This is the concept that's being done in MyeloMatch, a large effort of the NCI of testing various combinations at MRD. I also have a study that is multi-center and trying to open it at multiple sites, which is targeting any leukemia that has this characteristic gene expression with revumenib. there are many exciting studies that are planned that I know of with menin inhibitors.
What about sort of AML in general? Any other research strategies you're excited about?
I think the major issue in AML had been the lack of efficacy in immune therapy. So we have a very good example in ALL with blinatumomab, which is a bispecific engager targeting CD19. And of course, we have CAR-Ts for ALL. But by and large, the data in AML on what we've tested as targets for bispecific engagers or CAR-Ts has not been great. So there are newer versions of these trials that are panning out. And I think this ASH, we're going to hear more about exciting results. I can't share yet, but I know for sure this would be fun.
How about if you can tell me what kind of targets people are looking at? Because I'm just curious. You can't tell me that either?
I can tell you about a trial that's about to that has launched 3 months ago. And I can tell you about the concept. We don't have any clinical results yet. And this is this time a leukemia-specific antigen. So instead of targeting, let's say, CD33, which is a marker on AML cells and also normal hematopoietic cells, this one is a target that is preferentially expressed on leukemia cells called CG1, cathepsin G. And the molecule is a bispecific engager of CG1 and CD3. So it would be an HLA context-dependent molecule, just like the example would be DLL3 and small cell lung cancer or MAGE or GP100 in melanoma. So this trial just launched. I think the preclinical data is very, very solid. So I'm excited to see the results.
Any ADCs or radio-labeled products?
Yeah, the best results have been with a CD123 antibody drug conjugate called PVEC or pivekimumab. It led to single agent responses, but the overall response rate overall is small, about 10 to 20%. And I'm not sure about the development plan after that. For sure, it could have preferential activity in BPDCN, which is a rare acute myeloid leukemia subtype that has very high CD123. So the results in there would be very interesting. And, you know, we have the example of gemtuzumab already approved as an ADC.
Right, right. What about radio-labeled compounds?
I've heard of a few without great responses so far. There was one that was used almost like a conditioning for transplant, but it led to increased mortality, so the trial was stopped. I'm not aware of any other results that look great.
Anything we should be looking forward to at ASH that you can talk about?
I think new immune therapies. There would be hopefully new results of the combinations with menin. That's the parts that I'm involved in, and I'm sure you know a lot of people would have exciting stuff to share at ASH.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Issa, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.